to be American.
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
It's an old maxim. Don't discuss politics at the dinner table. It's too divisive, too polarizing, too unappetizing. We seem to treat political disagreement as something to avoid in polite company. No wonder we have such a hard time talking about the biggest issues of the day without it devolving into partisan bickering. Many Americans feel more isolated in their political views than ever before. We assume the worst about the other side. We unfriend people we disagree with. We curate our media diets. And too often, when political conversations do happen, they quickly devolve into defensiveness, caricature, and partisan bickering. But democracy depends on citizens talking to one another, listening, questioning, and ultimately persuading. Democracy requires productive political conversations. So how do we do better? Here to teach us how to have better conversations across the political divide is Monica Guzman. She's a self-described bridge builder, journalist, and the author of the best-selling book, I Never Thought of It That Way, How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. Monica, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Hey, hey, thank you for having me.
So first, before we dive into how to have better political conversations, why is building bridges such an important part of the work that you do?
I am a Mexican immigrant, and I've always felt like I've had one foot in that origin story and another one here in the United States. So in my own biography, I have a lot of sort of dueling identities. And I think it's folks who have that in their own lives who know that building bridges is ultimately possible and can be really, really cool. You end up being the translators between different worlds, and it can feel rewarding. And as for how it's become central to my work, I'm also in a politically divided family. My parents went one way politically. I went another when we became citizens and began voting. And hilarity ensued. Mm-hmm. Lots of arguments, lots of tension and friction. But somehow we really were able to keep things to a simmer instead of having them get so hot that they burned our trust in each other or our relationships or our sense of dignity. And when that happened, I thought, man, I want to get these techniques into some space where they can be shared. And I want to research more of them. And I want to understand what it is we may have stumbled upon and what more we can learn.
The book starts off with this anecdote about your parents and how you went different ways politically. Your book, I Never Thought of It That Way, is really about how to cross the political divide in our discourse with one another. You said your parents and you became U.S. citizens, started voting, but went very different ways politically. How did you manage that initially, and how did you learn to manage it?
I mean, initially, we managed it like we managed every other conversation in our family growing up. We argued. We argued a lot. We would argue over our red Formica table, and I just have images of that throughout my childhood. Sometimes it would get really intense, like the conversations in the car on the way home from one Michael Moore documentary I remember growing up. And then with the 2016 presidential election, it really tested our family in the ways that I think it tested a lot of families. So at that point, it became about how much we dared to really get curious about each other's perspectives rather than just attack each other's perspectives. That ended up becoming the really important distinction. And I remember it was those conversations where something in my reactions to their candidate and who they chose to support calmed down enough for me to say, wait a minute, Dad. Who are you? Like, what led you to think of these things so differently than I think of things? And he then started to ask me very similar questions. And that's when we were able to kind of bring the heat down enough to get to understanding. And when we got to understanding, that transformed everything. It transformed our differences from a threat into something like a challenge and an opportunity.
So maybe that was important as a father-daughter relationship, but I'm curious how you manage that sort of dynamic with someone who's not in your family, but you just encounter, who has clearly different worldviews. I mean, you just said that, you know, you kind of let the tension simmer down where you could start to get a little bit of understanding. But how do you get to that point where the tensions can even simmer in these political discourse we're having today?
Well, so much depends on the relationship and the expectations you have in each other. So, you know, while you might think, oh, maybe it's easier within a family relationship, sometimes it's harder within a family relationship than with a stranger, because with a stranger, you have no expectations, no sense of investment. But with a family, it's how could my mother believe this, you know? And that adds a sense of animating emotional reactivity to everything. So with strangers, it depends on the context, but sometimes it can be easier to go from judgment into curiosity. Well, who is this person? How did they get here? One of the most powerful techniques I teach is to switch from asking why people believe what they believe to asking how they came to believe what they believe. Whether it's somebody you know or a stranger, it's equally effective. Get folks to tell stories rather than just give reasons that hop right into arguments, where you might be so caught up by the need to win and to be right that you let go of that first task in any even persuasive endeavor, which is to try to understand where each other is even coming from.
So asking how do you come to believe that doesn't put them on the defensive anymore, does it? Right? Why do you think that maybe is puts you in a defensive posture where mm-hmm. how did you come to believe that makes them tell stories, as you said, right?
Right.
Well, I was going to ask you about this radical curiosity, right? So you talk about not just being curious, but being radically curious. And I'm curious what you mean by that. You know, how does someone become radically curious?
What that means is that you maintain or come back to a sense of curiosity, even when what you really want is to run away. That's what that means. When you're really uncomfortable, when everything inside you is telling you, you don't like this person, you're not going to learn anything from this, radical curiosity is saying, no, I am missing something. I know I am, because I can't know everybody around me. So can I stay in that heat? And can I switch from judgment back into curiosity? That kind of curiosity, radical curiosity, is what we're going to need with the degree to which we are siloed and separate. We're trapped in this vicious cycle where we're judging each other more while we're engaging each other less. And if you hit fast forward on that dynamic, that we're judging each other more while engaging each other less, what are our judgments based on? They're based on reports of what other people think that are often exaggerated instead of what other people actually think. Meanwhile, we're telling ourselves that we're too afraid or that it's just not going to be worthwhile to approach each other. But if we don't get close enough to each other to hear what we actually think, we're going to get caught in misperceptions and exaggerations, and we're not going to see the world as it is.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about that silo aspect that you just mentioned, and that is part of the book as well. You know, if you look at our social media feeds, it tends to be people who agree with us. If you look at what news Americans turn on, they tend to get it from a source that reaffirms their own prior beliefs. So how do you break that cycle of, you know, the fact that we are all so siloed and that means the other side is easy to villainize?
Yes. And that's definitely a big issue right now. We're into our grooves and it's difficult to want to leave them. So one technique that I teach is often when we read media, we are looking for ammo. You know, we're looking for affirmation of what we believe and then sort of like rhetorical ammo to launch at our opponents. So one exercise is to look at an article that the headline is clearly showing you that it's going to be an opinion article and it disagrees with you, but you know that it's a widely held opinion that you don't understand. So the technique is click into that article instead of just letting it enrage you and moving on. Mm-hmm. Read that article asking yourself two questions. What are the deep down, honest human concerns that are animating this perspective? Which is difficult enough to answer generously if you've already got your guard up. And the second question is, what is the strongest argument on this other side? And again, you're doing this in conversation with yourself. So there's no risk, you know, that anyone's going to judge you. You're just doing it with yourself. What you're doing is you're practicing curiosity against the odds. You know, what this polarized world expects of you is that if you see a perspective that you don't like, you're going to continue to dislike it. You're going to push it away even more. You're going to look into it for evidence of why these people are crazy, stupid, or evil, instead of the counterculture move, the thing that's really going to dig us out of this hole, is to remind ourselves that these are other human beings who came to different conclusions. So what can I do with my mind to wrest it into this position of being curious when it wants to be conclusive?
We're speaking with Monica Guzman, the author of the book, I Never Thought of It That Way, How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. Monica, we're talking about how you can expose yourself to the viewpoints of the other side, become fearlessly curious, but wouldn't it be easier to just disengage? I mean, you know, the world is crazy out there. Polls show that Americans view political conversations as stressful rather than constructive. So how do you cut up against that feeling of, I can just, you know, go and, you know, live my daily life and, you know, let the people in D.C. figure this stuff out and not have to deal with that kind of stress?
If only. If only an effective way to combat the stress in our world was to avoid the stressful conversations. The truth of the matter is, the most stressful things in our world are happening because we are avoiding those conversations. So we may be avoiding the kind of individual singular stress of this conversation that we're dreading, but when all of us choose to not have those, then what do we get on the other side? We get reactionary politics. We get toxic discursive culture. We get people cutting each other off and damaging relationships rather than trying to do the work of getting to understanding. We get a sadder, more fearful world that can't see itself. That's stressful. You know, that to me is the biggest stress. And when you ask people where a lot of their anxiety comes from, a lot of it is coming from a sense of helplessness and despair when they think that all of these mechanisms and systems are running away from them. So I think it's more about us picking up the reins that are ours. You mentioned at the top of this episode, democracy, that's talking to each other. There's no way to avoid it. That's what this work is. So if we put that down and leave it to everybody else in DC to figure it out, they can't do it without us. They can't do it without us. The only way they can do it is with a fear-driven playbook that is burying us right now.
And this runs beyond politics, right? I mean, it's really about how we interact with people throughout our society. I saw one stat in a poll that 45% of Democrats and 38% of Republicans would be upset if their child married someone from the other party. And those numbers are way up from the 1960s. So the problem runs really deep. Do you think something's changed in the past several, you know, past decade or past two decades that has caused this to be even more about politics, but about the way we run our lives?
Yes. So what's happened is that our political differences have coincided with a bunch of other demographic differences. And we just have these two neat and tidy little stacks, which makes it a lot easier if I know my group and I know who is against my group, it's easier for me to identify those people and identify my people. So these identity-driven sort of attachment-based psychologies lead us to put even more weight on the stories we tell ourselves about who is with us and who is against us. And those stories become so strong because they're reinforced by the fact that we are more and more surrounding ourselves with people who think like us. So as research shows, when you surround yourself with people who share your instincts, you'll also share your blind spots. And one of the blind spots happens to be, we don't need them. We've got it. We understand everything already ourselves. So yes, all of these things have kind of conspired and conflated this sorting and othering and siloing to make a lot of us have a more narrow worldview while thinking that we see enough of the world.
And that othering is really, I think, a significant factor of this, right? Where the other side is not just they have different viewpoints, but they have a whole different worldview, which is incompatible with mine, right? So I'm curious if you can teach me, you know, I'm a law professor of voting rights, and so I talk a lot about, you know, election results in the 2020 election. So I want to get specific. Teach me, when someone says to me, the 2020 election was fraudulent, it was clear it was stolen, it was clear Donald Trump won, And as a researcher, I know that that is just false, right? That is just not fact-based. So how would you recommend I handle a conversation with someone who is 100% absolutely convinced that the election was rigged and that Biden didn't actually win the 2020 election?
Yeah. So step one is probably to step out of that topic and build some trust with the person. Because if you come in and say, you're wrong, well, you're not going to persuade them of anything and they're not going to feel heard by you. And the conversation is going to end without a lot of movement, more than likely. But if you can step out of that topic enough to get to know the person and to demonstrate that you're interested in them and how they came to believe what they believe, then you might have a shot of getting enough calibration to get to the point where you can say, I know that you believe these things. I see it super differently. And I wonder if we can really talk about that. Now, if you need a faster way in, I would say that in that moment, when this difference comes up and they're saying it's clear, this was fraudulent, then it's about asking questions, not issuing corrections. So how did you come to believe that? Or even more broadly, there's a really powerful question around what, yeah, I know that not everybody is trusting our elections right now. What are your biggest concerns about our elections right now? And so that way you're asking them what they're worried about. You're stepping away from the conversation about what's true, where you can easily get stuck before you've built enough trust to move each other. And instead you switch to the conversation about what's meaningful. What do you worry about? What are your concerns? And once they start talking about concerns, you'll start to get to a conversation about values. Because when you ask people what they worry about, you learn what they care about. You find a lot of common ground in that conversation. You start to build trust and rapport. And then again, you can come back to the disagreement on what's true and you can be as non-judgmental as possible. That's what works. Just, you got to tell you, that's not my understanding. And I'm really confident in my understanding. And it sounds like you're really confident in yours. So can we talk a little more about how we came to such different conclusions?
I love that. I love that approach because it really is about having a dialogue, right? You talked about shared values as part of your response. And I know in the book, you talk about how you've, you know, had instances and seminars and conversations where you get people from opposite sides to talk about what they care most about. And then you see shared values. Can you tell us a little bit or maybe an anecdote that really stuck out to you in this work where you saw people from the opposite political spectrum realizing that they have shared values?
The anecdote that comes to mind was there was a workshop I did in the Midwest in Ohio, and we do these 4-minute exercises where, you know, there's a couple of instructions, but mostly you're really, really, really listening to your partner. And as the partner, you are working hard to explain a perspective while someone else is asking you questions. And we came out of that and somebody said, I just changed my mind on an issue. And I said, whoa, how did that happen? The person that she was talking with was not challenging her opinion. All they were doing was asking questions of understanding, just to try to understand her perspective. But here's the thing that happened. She had very rarely been confronted with her own opinion. She had very rarely had a witness in another human being who wanted to know why she thought what she thought. And so in a way, it's like, the value that connected each other was just curiosity. I'm just curious about what you think. And so they both became curious about what the one person thought. And in the course of 4 minutes, as she was voicing what she thought she believed, she found contradictions and decided that she actually needed to change her mind. I found that just amazing. And it shows that the kind of value that is most important to calibrate on is that we actually care for each other. In this moment, in this conversation, we may disagree, but I want you to be like, you know, feeling good talking to me. And I want you to feel like I'm here, you know, receiving you, that I'm not threatening you and that I don't need to change you. And once you agree on that value, anything can happen.
Wow, that's great. The book was published in 2022. Donald Trump was elected in 2024 for his second term. Has anything changed in your perspective since the book was published about how you're approaching these kinds of conversations in this work?
Lots. I feel like when I published my book, I had felt like I had learned so much and I had spent so much time researching and trying to gather up all the stories I could. But now it's been 4 years of doing that, but accelerated. I just spent 2 weeks in South Africa learning about apartheid. I went to the West Bank last year I've traveled all over America, meeting communities of conservatives and liberals and libertarians and everyone else, meeting families, people who have been through the worst pain of what the divide can cause, and also found a way to heal it. I feel like I am filled with stories. So has my perspective changed meaningfully on what's in the book insofar as these techniques and how important they are? Absolutely not. I have doubled down on those things.
Mm-hmm.
However, if I were to write the book now, I would have probably 2 whole chapters on fear. I would spend more time with the relationship between truth and trust, because I think it's a barrier for people that they're so loyal to truth that it's hard to step away from a conversation about what's true in order to build trust so that you can then move on the conversation about what's true again. So there's things like this that I'm learning, watching the world in the context of so much of this get even harder and the stakes get even higher, where it feels like, you know, that I'm on this burner and the heat's turning up. And so I'm seeing things that previously might have escaped me. And now I just want to capture those and find the techniques about those and make a new book like yesterday.
So let's say a listener is convinced. They recognize they want to have fiercely curious conversations. They recognize that better conversations can help sustain and save democracy. What's the one thing you would tell them to do first?
Get curious about yourself. Ask yourself, what kinds of people do you always talk about but never with? Like, make that list. And then ask yourself how you could engage those people more curiously. Even if it's one more question, even if it's one conversation, even if it's lurking on a subreddit somewhere, but with a curious mindset, any little step, that is literally taking a step in the work of democracy. In democracy, we don't talk about each other. We don't just do that. We talk to each other. That's why this works.
And then what would you say they should do to shift their mindset to being curious once they create that list?
Notice your assumptions. So if an assumption or a judgment comes up as you look at the headlines, as you look around your world, oh, it's because those people are blank. The first step to getting curious is to even notice the assumptions you're making. How many of those people do you know? Have you talked to any of them recently? You know, those people are blank. Can you be sure? So once you notice an assumption, you can turn it into a question. And that's where curiosity is born.
Monica, I read this book and I just devoured it. I love the messages from it. As someone who cares so much about sustaining democracy, as someone who has a show called Democracy Optimist, this book really spoke to me and spoke to the kinds of conversations I hope we can all have. Monica Guzman is the author of I Never Thought of It That Way, How to Have Fearlessly Curious Conversations in Dangerously Divided Times. You can learn more about her at www.moniguzman.com. Monica, thank you for joining Democracy Optimist.
You bet. Thank you so much for having me.
You know, Josh, I have a hunch that in politically divided families, a question that Monica Guzman says she and her father have asked each other is one that's been raised in many American households where everyone assumed that they knew everyone. So if you would take us back to that passage in your conversation with Monica, what did she say about dealing with this level of division that's leading to estrangement among families?
Yeah, that was really touching, in fact, because she talked about how getting to know someone through these kinds of curious conversations is really more about politics. It transcends, you know, what person we're going to vote for. It's really about who they are as a person. And of course, you know, our values very much shape our political views, but we're so much more than that as well. And so I really took her to be saying, let's have these conversations where we try to get to know each other and not, you know, put someone on the spot and say, why do you think that? Because that doesn't get to know who they are. But tell me how you came about to think that way. Let's the person open up more. Let's the person really tell you about their core views and their core values. And that's how you can get to know someone better as well.
Well, and she did throw out a really interesting and provocative challenge there at the very end of the conversation when you ask her what can be done to preserve democracy. And she said, make a list of people that you don't think you would ever talk to and talk to them.
Yeah, that was great advice. And also be curious with yourself first. Why do you have these assumptions about these people? and then go out and reach out to them. I think democracy is sustained by getting out of our silos, by getting out of the echo chamber of our social media feeds, and actually talking to people who might differ from us and have different views.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host. Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm the series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Landon Palmer, research assistant, Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at democracyoptimist.com and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. If you'd like to get in touch, our email is democracyoptimist@gmail.com. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Democracy Optimist from Eastern Standard and WEKU.